presentation, and thank you all for making it through the afternoon. So some of you who are familiar with medication, with access to medication in Medicaid, may be thinking, well, why is this presentation on Medicaid in the aging section? Because all of the dual eligibles have been moved, everybody who's aged or disabled, have been moved into Medicare as of 2006. The point here that my co-author and I wanted to make is that, when Medicaid started, it was relatively open access to medication, fairly good coverage, and over time, as cost pressures increased, we started to see more and more hard limits on the number of prescriptions you could get, more strict formularies going into place through the preferred drug list. We see that almost over two-thirds of states now have them. And as we're hearing now, there's more and more calls to bring prices and costs in Medicare down to a similar level as Medicaid. And our point here is, let's look at this a little bit. Look at what the track record was in Medicaid in controlling some of these things with hard limits before we impose this on the Medicare system. And so I'm going to talk to you a bit about the policy overall, and then we're going to look specifically how this affected the elderly in Medicaid, and we're looking at Alabama. And so just as a bit of a setup, this is going to be looking at the effect of a preferred drug list on the class of medications called statins, which lower cholesterol. They're widely accepted, widely used. Benefits have shown that they reduce morbidity and mortality. The longer you're on them, the more you tend to benefit from being on them. There's a huge adherence problem with statins, as there are in many chronic medications. More adherent patients tend to have lower hospitalizations and emergency department visits. But as we've seen in the Medicaid system, those budgets tend to be managed separately, so that cutting down on the medication budget, if people go to the hospital, it isn't necessarily looked at holistically. And again, we're just trying to raise that. But if we're thinking about doing these kinds of things in Medicare, let's be thinking about this a bit more holistically. Heart disease, as you all know, is the leading cause of death in the United States, and it's 29% of all deaths in Alabama, where we did this study. Alabama implemented a preferred drug list, which basically says, patients, you have access to these medications, to this set of medications, and the ones that you don't have access to, your doctor needs to fill out paperwork or call a number or send in a fax in order to allow you to have access to that medication. What you'll see in the study is the vast majority of patients who are on one of those restricted medications just get switched to another drug. Their doctors are either overburdened by the paperwork and don't switch them, or feel that it's fine for them to be switched. But what this study will show is that there's an adherence effect there that may not be considered. So what we looked at is, was there, once they put in these restrictions, you could switch to another drug, but did you not switch to another drug? Did that have the effect of lowering your likelihood of continuing on statin therapy? Did the restriction have increase the likelihood that you would be switched? Maybe these restrictions aren't that effective. A doctor just fills out the paper, you get to stay on the drug you were already on, which is your physician's first preferred medication. Maybe it doesn't have an effect, but we're going to see that it really does. Did the patients who were taking a medication that was restricted have a higher likelihood of quitting therapy? And were there any differences with older patients versus younger patients? And please, if anyone has questions on this, ask me as we're going. So the way we set this up was as a difference in difference in differences, three differences. We looked at Alabama compared to North Carolina. We selected North Carolina because they don't have the same policy. They're a southern state with similar demographics. We selected all patients. We wanted to look at patients who have been taking a statin for a while before the policy went into place to see what the effect of switching medications or restricting medications was on a stable population. So what we did, the policy went into place March 2004. We selected all patients who were taking a statin in the 3 months before the policy, and they had to have taken one at some point in the year. So they've been on for a while, and they're on right before the policy goes into place. We did that in Alabama and North Carolina. And then for our pre-cohort, we wanted a cohort that wasn't affected by the policy. We just shifted the whole thing 1 year earlier to March 2003. So by going year over year, we've sort of washed out seasonality, time differences, and then comparing state to state, we look at policy differences. This data came from VeriSpan. This is all prescription data. So, one of the limitations of the study I'll talk about at the end is we don't have medical records. It's all HIPAA-compliant, de-identified data. It includes all claims for statins over the time period. We only included pharmacies where Verispan consistently captured the data over the same time. So we didn't want anybody, you know, if a certain pharmacy network had dropped out, we didn't include that. We used census data to infer the demographics of the patient. So since we knew what the age and the gender of the patient was, but we didn't know what their socioeconomic status was. So we used the census data from the pharmacy, basically, to infer that. We knew the drug, we knew how many pills they had taken, so you could figure out how long they stayed on therapy. We only took people over 18, and I already described the inclusion criteria. They had to be taking the statin for a while before the study started. And then this is, you know, boring stuff, but we basically looked at your likelihood of discontinuing based on whether or not you were in that cohort that was affected by the policy, a vector of county-fixed effects, which would have included all these sociodemographics that we talked about. We looked at, so that was the simplest model. We looked at another model that included those plus the fact that you were taking a drug that was restricted, and then we looked at that model plus an indicator that you were 65 and over. We tried various different age groups. 65 and older was the only one that had a differential effect. And so here are just some baseline statistics. I'm not going to go into this too much, but basically what you see is that the populations are relatively balanced, similar proportion of urban, similar proportion of minority and poverty. Alabama is slightly more poor and slightly more ethnically diverse than North Carolina in this sample. This is how the population looked like before the study. They had been taking statins already for almost 200 days. About two-thirds of them in both samples were on one of these drugs that were restricted in Alabama. And on average, they'd had about 16% of days missed therapy when you looked before the study started. So they were fairly compliant patients. And then afterward, before the policy was implemented in both Alabama and North Carolina, patients tended to stay on therapy for about an average of 300 days over the next year where we followed them. After the policy in Alabama, that dropped down to 262 days, so almost a month less, and in North Carolina, it was unaffected. The days between prescriptions stayed about the same, so what that means is that people just tended to quit. They didn't have longer gaps in between prescriptions. And then we saw discontinuation rate, which we were defining as patients who had prescription for 50% or fewer of the days. Some authors will use 80%, some authors will use 50%. The model was robust to either specification. We picked the more conservative number. But what you see is that in Alabama, that number goes from 39% discontinuation up to 51% discontinuation. That's a huge increase. That's an 80% increase in discontinuation. What should be followed and studied now is what are the resultant effects on heart disease and use of hospitals and more expensive things. This is a graph just showing that darker line at the bottom is the continuation rate for Alabama post-policy. So you see this huge drop right around the time the policy was implemented in continuation. This is just the key takeaway. If you think of nothing else, continuation in North Carolina unaffected, and Alabama after the preferred drug list would have a huge decline. Again, a bunch of statistics, but on the base model, which is the model that looked for an average effect, we saw an 82% increase in the odds and the odds ratio that you would discontinue your medication. Some of the strong predictors of continuation were the longer you were on, the more likely you were to stay on, the more adherent you've been in the past, the more adherent you were likely to be in the future. Age is a strong predictor. Older people, on average, tended to stay on longer, tended to be more adherent. But when we look at model B, we see that, so that third line that says 1.42 in model B, older people were even more likely to be affected by the policy than younger people. There's several reasons why this could be. We don't know. That's not one of the things the study went into. It could be that older people were more likely to be confused when they went to the pharmacy and they were told, you can't have your same medication, you need to switch to something else. Older people tend to take more medications, and there's a cap on the number of prescriptions you can take each month, so perhaps they selected to stay on their pain medications but not on their statins. We don't know, but we also know that older people are in the highest risk group, and they're exactly the people you don't want to be quitting their medication. So if you're thinking about putting limits, you know, first of all, I would advocate some more thought around the limits, but you might want to consider carving out an older population from a limit or setting a different limit from them. 10 prescriptions a month, while it sounds like a lot, is not enough for an older person. especially an older person who may have multiple conditions. Many people in Medicaid also have mental health conditions. It's not that many prescriptions. So that was our takeaway, is that higher discontinuation, but particularly higher discontinuation in the elderly when you put in this kind of policy. So some of the limitations: this isn't a clinical trial, it's a retrospective analysis, it's claims data, the medical data wasn't available, and you know, this is looking at both the effect of an access restriction, so a formulary restriction, and then a total number of prescription limit at the same time, so it doesn't separate out those things differently. I guess the question you want to ask is, does this raise enough concern that you would want to look into the policy even without some of these other data elements available? You don't really have reason to believe that the population would have changed dramatically from year to year, so that you have this big of an increase in discontinuation should perhaps raise some questions with the policy. And I already said all that. So just in conclusion, you know, states have over time been put under more and more pressure to reduce their costs, and they've done that by putting in these hard limits on the number of prescriptions and the types of prescriptions that you can get. You know, these kinds of limits could be beneficial to society if they were to decrease costs without having any negative impact on health. However, if they have a negative impact on health, they're not increasing the net benefit to society, and we need to look at this holistically. Evidence suggests that this has an adherence effect. Before we import this type of policy into any other program, let's look a little bit at how these policies have affected other programs. And you know, no one's intending to kick anybody off their medication or send them into the hospital when they put this into these kinds of policies into place. But some retrospective analysis should be done before these policies are carried over into more programs, because it could ultimately lead to a significant decline in health and social welfare. So, thank you, everyone.